Okay, I'm going to do it. I call the meeting of the House of Higher Education, Finance, and Policy to order. Members, please take your seat. And there is a quorum present. There we go. And may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 29th, 2019?
So moved.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wolgamott moves the minutes for January 29th, 2017. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. So it looks like we have some technical difficulties happening, but we're making progress, I understand. So I wanted to get started because we have a full agenda today, and we have an open house that if we get done, we will be able to go to that for the Minnesota State University System over in the Capitol. So that will be something that we can all look forward to. So today we have a presentation by the Minnesota Student Association. The Minnesota Student Association is the undergraduate student government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. They advocate for student interests at the university and work to shape university policy by working with university administrators, the Board of Regents, and policymakers at every level of government. We have joining us the student body president at MSA, Simran Mishra, as well as along with the vice president, Mina Kian, and then we have Christina Laridan, and she is the government affairs team. This looks like an impressive team here, and I'm glad that you were able to join us. Welcome, and if each of you could introduce yourself, and then I will kind of signify who wants to start, and I will recognize you.
Hi, my name is Simran Mishra.
I'm Christina Laridan.
And I'm Mina Kian.
Thank you for being here. And, okay, excellent. So, Simran Mishra,
yes.
who is the student body president of Minnesota Student Association, will begin.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and the honorable members of the committee for having us here today. We are honored to represent the Minnesota Student Association alongside many students who are also here to discuss the vision of MSA as well as our mission and our goals with you today. All of our vision, our mission, and our goals are driven really by the needs of undergraduate students at the Twin Cities, and we're excited for you to learn more. As Chair Bernardi said, my name is Simran Mishra. I'm from Golden Valley, Minnesota. I am a fourth-year student entering my last semester at the university studying finance at the Carlson School of Management.
And I am Christina Laridan. I do government legislative affairs. Sorry?
We're going to proceed.
Okay, thank you. So I do government and legislative affairs for the Minnesota Student Association. I'm originally from Prior Lake, Minnesota, and I am studying political science in the College of Liberal Arts as well as agricultural policy in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resource Sciences.
Excellent. And Christina Laridan, I'm guessing that you're going to be introducing yourself a little bit more in depth right now as well. You may proceed.
And my name is Mina Kian. I am the student body vice president for the undergraduate students on the Twin Cities campus. I'm a fourth-year student studying electrical engineering, computer science, and Latin, and I am from the uptown area of Minneapolis.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee again. And we're going to be getting an overview of what your mission and what your vision and mission is, goals and challenges, and who would like to start. Okay, and I'm going to get it right this time. It's Mina Kian.
Yes.
Thank you. You may proceed.
So, before we go into the mission of our organization, I think it's important to acknowledge the purpose of higher education, and specifically higher education at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. As a land-grant institution of the state, the U of M serves to not only do research that drives the innovation of the state, but also serves to go and educate the next community of leaders and like community changers for the state of Minnesota. And so we have this mission to go and educate this next generation. And yet we find that many students do face barriers as they go through their 4, 5, 6 years at our institution. it's the responsibility of the Minnesota Student Association to first identify those barriers for students and then work to advocate to remove those barriers so that students have the maximum opportunity to learn during their time at our institution. We work in partnership with university administrators on institutional policy changes. We do a lot of incredible campaign work to really change a lot of the like the stigma around different issues that we're facing on students as campus. And we also work with legislators at every level of government to support changing our community. And I do also want to mention that the Minnesota Student Association serves to represent undergraduate students on the Twin Cities campus. There are multiple other organizations that serve to represent students on our peer institutions in, you know, Morris, Crookston, Rochester, and Duluth. And we also have another council that serves to represent graduate and professional students. So what do we do? Simon and I were elected in the spring election of 2018, and we were actually elected with 80% of the vote to go and lead the Minnesota Student Association. We manage a staff of 35 individuals, and naturally, because class is canceled today, a lot of these individuals are sitting in the audience right now. Do you want to wave? And we work in conjunction with an elected body of representatives who are also here. We have two teams that we wanted to highlight today, specifically the Governmental Legislative Affairs team, led by Jude Goosens from Duluth, Minnesota. The GLA team works to advocate for legislation that can go and empower students across all of our campuses and works to make them civically engaged. We also have two representatives to the Board of Regents who are also here, if you guys want to wait. And they work to represent students at the highest level of governance at our institution. These two individuals work to, in collaboration with the rest of the RDR team, to do an annual report that highlights things that we need to change at the highest level institution across all of our campuses. So some key initiatives that we work on. This past semester we did a mental health campaign called Listen. You can go and find the brochure and the video for that on our website, which will be linked at the end of this presentation. We also do things to advocate for academic issues that students face. We work with our sustainability and infrastructure committees to address a lot of like institutional structural changes that need to occur. And we also have a campus life committee and a D&I committee that work on changing the campus culture to make sure that it's healthy for students. Simon will then go into a few of these initiatives.
Great. Okay, and you may proceed and get the Ms. Simran.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. So I'll begin by talking about textbook affordability. The cost of textbooks, quite simply, is shocking. The College Board estimates that students spend roughly $1,300 on textbooks every year. And this number is a lot higher for students in STEM and in design and other courses that require more detailed or more course materials. In fact, the CPI, the Consumer Price Index for textbooks, over the last 40 years has increased by over 800%. 7 out of 10 students have chosen not to buy a textbook because of the cost, which means that they're going into classes without the required textbooks and as a result may not do as well just simply because they can't afford it. I even have many friends who have dropped their classes or classes that they were interested in because they couldn't afford the course materials. Some students try to save money by buying reused textbooks, but every 3 to 4 years, publishers will put out a new edition of a textbook, and sometimes these textbooks have little to no changes being made to them. But now they're required to buy this new textbook by professors and have to pay more expensive prices whatsoever, nonetheless. But there is a better way. Open educational resources are openly licensed text, media, or other format used for teaching or other academic purposes. They can significantly reduce the cost of textbooks for students as they're available at little or no cost. In our agricultural college, CFANS, many professors have paved the way by utilizing open educational resources in many of their courses. However, there are still many, many courses as well as disciplines that simply don't have the high quality educational open resources that are available to them. And as a result, there's a barrier in utilizing open educational resources, which could be very, very beneficial to students. So we need additional investment in these areas so that quality resources can continue to be published and more professors and academics can consider this as an option. On the university end, our Minnesota Student Association has been working with administrators and faculty to ensure that professors understand the true cost of the textbooks that they're assigning to their students, that they're reusing their textbooks whenever possible, that they're open to using an older older edition of a textbook, knowing that it will be cheaper to students, and that we continue to support our professors who would like to contribute to open educational resources. And then we can move on to talk about the next topic, which is data privacy. Per Minnesota Government Practices Act, as well as Board of Regents policy, student directory information is available to anyone who requests access. So that includes a student's name, their street address, their email address, their phone number, their dates of enrollment, their enrollment status, other academic details, and upon graduation, the degree that they were awarded. Students have the ability to suppress this data, but this service is vastly underutilized by Twin Cities students on our campus, as only 18% of students have chosen to suppress any level of data in 2017. There's immense potential for third-party individuals to misuse this data, whether that's for advertising, whether that's for recruitment, or for financial gain. In fact, I had all three of those happen to me before I chose to suppress my data. MSA just unanimously passed a resolution that calls for the creation of a limited directory in which access to student email, street address, as well as the phone number and their ID card photograph will only be accessible to internal parties at the University of Minnesota. So we're calling on our university to take action in this way to protect sensitive information that, as I said, could be used for financial gain, advertising, or recruitment by external third parties. We also called upon the university to maintain documentation of the external parties who submit a request for more than 100 students' information and that this documentation be made available upon request. Our student representatives to the Board of Regents plan to work closely with the Regents to express their concerns as well as solutions on this issue. Representative Lucero, who's not present, but we know that he is very passionate that on the issue of data privacy, and we hope to work with him and any other legislators who might be interested in this issue to continue work on this important issue. And next, Christina will touch on some of the issues pertaining government and legislative affairs.
Thank you. All right, so I want to start things off by just mentioning that I had the privilege of running the voter registration effort this year on campus, and what I experienced in the field working with many other student organizations was incredible students that are very, very passionate about getting their peers to vote, but there were tons of roadblocks to that. Mostly it's cold out, and nobody wants to get registered when they're walking by you on their way to class. And so a lot of these students were very, very passionate about it, but there are limitations to what we can do on the ground as students registering other people manually. And so one of our initiatives that we're really excited about this year is we are hoping to integrate voter registration into our student programs. And what this would essentially look like is when students enroll in the university, they're automatically prompted to get registered to vote so that students are doing it on their own time. They're already filling out a bunch of other paperwork in order to get them to go, you know, enroll in the university. So we just want to roll that into those programs so that students are already ready to do that. We also need to acknowledge the fact that 62% of people who are not registered have never even been asked to do so. And this is extremely more prevalent with students because for most of them it's their first time voting and they've never been registered before. And there's the added complication of the fact that they're at a university. Do they register there? Do they register at home? How do I register? So there are tons of added complications for university students, which is why we're so excited about the potential of this program. We're also very excited about it because only one other university has done this in the way that we are hoping to, and that's Northwestern University in Illinois. I've had the chance to speak to some of their people who actually implemented that program a couple of years ago, and now 97% of their student body is registered to vote, which is incredible considering the fact that our student body is four times the size of theirs, and so we would become a model for the rest of the nation to go about these integrated voter registration programs as well. So this is something that we're extremely excited about. Moving on to some of our other legislative initiatives, we're also hoping to expand medical amnesty. This is something that has come up in the past that we worked a lot on in the past. This resolution is specifically about protecting victims of sexual assault, making sure that when there are controlled substances involved, that these students don't have to fear calling for medical help and medical attention. They don't have to fear being given a minor for that situation. This bill was introduced last year by Representative and now Congresswoman Omar, and it was passed unanimously in the Senate and just couldn't quite make it across the finish line, but we're really excited to continue with this because we do know that this has happened on our campus. We know that it does happen to students, and it is a deterrent for people in general who may need help but are afraid about potential consequences. So this is another thing that we're really hoping to work together on in the future. And I do also want to note briefly that recently at the Association of Big Ten Students Conference at Purdue University, the Association of Big Ten Students did pass unanimously a resolution. Did pass the resolution in support of this program as well. So moving on to housing and landlord accountability, this is something that we do have introduced as it's SF-125 currently. We're looking forward to getting that in the House as well. But essentially what this is doing is we are hoping to protect students, many of whom it's their first time signing a lease ever, or potentially any contract of any kind. And so the main tenets of this are we want to change the definition of a written residential lease to be unit specific. This one was actually personal to me because I signed my very first lease ever at the beginning of last year for the unit that I'm living in now. And I had no idea what unit I was going to be living in, but I did know that if I were on the third floor or lower, then my rent rate would be a flat given rate that they told me. But if it were any higher than that, it would go $15 for each floor that I was up per month, and luckily I ended up on the third and didn't have to pay those extra prices. But if I would have ended up on a higher floor, my rent price would have been significantly different. So that's just something that we hope to help students with some clarity, especially because, as I mentioned, a lot of students don't know what to look for in these leases. And we also want to require written residential leases to identify clearly on the first page the start and end date of the lease. This is because we have something that's colloquially known on many campuses as homeless month. That's because the leases end and old leases end and new leases begin about a month separated from each other. And if there are students who need to stay on campus for research opportunities, internships, or whatever circumstances they may have, they're without a place to live for an entire month. And so that can be incredibly stressful for students, especially on their pockets. And then we also want to express our support for another part of this that was added by Senator Dibble to standardize the notice to quit and notice of rent increase, just to ensure that students aren't being penalized for quitting their lease. We don't want students to have to give a 60-day notice of quitting their lease and then a 30-day notice of raised rent, so that students aren't penalized for that. Like I said, for many students, this is their first time signing a lease, and that's why we believe that these protections are so important, because not all students have access to family support or other means to support them in this complicated process. And then finally, we couldn't be here today without discussing the university's budget request. So we are in support of this request for $87 million. This university has made us the people that we are, and we're all so proud to be Gophers. And this will send us out on our way into the real world. And we believe that this university needs to be supported because we believe that we contribute a lot to Minnesota. I also want to stress that this request is not going to be keeping tuition flat for resident undergraduates. This is simply retaining the best faculty members and keeping our cutting-edge resources. But everybody always on campus, it's a huge topic. The rate of tuition is incredibly difficult for students to be able to deal with. Students currently pay about 58% of the cost of education, but in the past, in 1990, it was only students only had to pay 25% of that. And I think that the university has definitely been improving, but on the backs of students, that's really a difficult cost for us to be able to bear. And so that's the purpose of those of that ask. And we're also really excited to be able to talk to you more about that at our Support the U Day, which is going to be on April 3rd. We're going to have students from all five system campuses there, so you can learn more about all of our initiatives. So keep your calendars open on that day. We'll be reaching out to set up meetings with you so that you can meet the students in your district, because U of M students do come from your district, and I can confidently say that to every single one of you.
Thank you for your presentation. I do have a couple members. Go ahead. Are you?
I was going to say, on the last page, one, we want to thank all of you for your time today. We are really appreciative of this opportunity. And two, we would really love to work with all of you going forward, whether that is on legislation or whether that is just if you want to hear what the student voice on an issue is. We have our email address as well as our website listed here, and our business cards in your folders. So with that, just wanted to conclude.
Thank you, Ms. Mishra. We have two members on the list, and we will start with Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, it'd be nice, maybe the staff could help pull it together. The discussion of tuition is more or less universal. I know in here they start some references from 1990. There'd be two things of interest, MinSCU versus the U of M system, and then have tuition normalized at the 1990, and then how that has changed. One would be by actual dollars, so we see that how it's raised and varied. The other would be see it as a portion of the funding. And I think has brought up before the proportion of their funding that's state versus tuition. That might be illuminating, plus how it's changed in those decades may assist us in some of our discussions. And now for the testifiers, you were talking about it's cold to register. All the ones down in my area, we do it indoors. But that might vary by campus. And I do want to say that I like the rent idea. I was in the Centennial Hall myself, so I avoided some of it. We were in our house at that time was the top two floors, and we didn't get charged extra, so I guess we're fortunate. But I do remember that some of the taller ones and newer ones and the private-owned ones had those type of things, and that's not the kind of lesson we want to be teaching them is about how your contract can mess you over, but it does happen to my last session. They didn't give the full length. You had to do it 12 months. Well, after the 12 months was up, every 2 months they raised it, and there's all these hoops. And frankly, I like your bill, and once that gets done, we might look at, taking and cross-pollinating that to help, renters across the state for a little bit of transparency and fairness. And I like how the students can show us the way to go maybe on that. I did have the question about books. I understand the price tag. They add zeros if it's a textbook. What type of discussions have you tried to push for soft accessibility? Because as statewide, we might be able to negotiate a better rate so they could just do it, on your iPad or on your laptop. And then you save your back from carrying around. They're not thin. But, the transportability, that'd be nice. What I'd like to understand, if you looked at some of those options and maybe help the administration realize that, what century is it?
Ms. Mishra.
Chair Bernardi, honorable members, that is a question. The question of soft textbooks or online materials is one that we have been vocal on as well. Specifically, we've been working with the University of Minnesota Library System to improve the accessibility of online textbooks. Not only do they help students in the sense of affordability, but they can also oftentimes be cheaper. So those are definitely conversations we're having simultaneously, and also a mechanism we're looking at to save costs for university students.
Thank you. Okay, so Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. So two questions, one on the student data privacy that you have in your presentation here, and then the other, which I'll start with, is in regards to the rent or the lease legislation that you're looking at. So I don't know if any of the three of you were in front of the Civil Law Committee last year, of which this same legislation came forward, and we had a really good bill hearing with a really good discussion. But there were some concerns that were uncovered during that bill hearing, and just one of them, going back on my recollection here, was the requirement for the first page. So I happen to be a landlord, and the first two, maybe one or two pages of my leases are definitions of terms. And so the thing I would just put forward for you to take a look at is maybe go back and watch the civil law hearing from last year and maybe incorporate some of those ideas. And another would be perhaps the language, at least from last year, was for the entire state. It was modifying leases for all types of housing. So I, for example, have single-family homes that I rent out. So some of the stuff just wasn't necessarily applicable. So the other option for you to look at with your proposed language would be to narrow it, instead of all rental unit types in the entire state, narrow it to maybe student housing on the campus, or come up with some language of that effect. Then the other part in your presentation, the student data privacy, a huge topic for me. So it's something I've been fighting for in the K through 12 realm, but I definitely know that it is a concern for each and every one of us inside education and outside, because it is a multi-billion dollar industry where companies are in the position to harvest information on us, data mine it, share it, and much of it without our permission or even knowledge. So please, I would love to hear your ideas on proposals for legislation. I'd love to work with you on that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, excellent. Thank you. And you did get a shout out earlier by the members when you weren't quite here yet.
Oh, okay.
I mean by the testifiers.
Ah, okay.
Thank you. And our last question is Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the textbook affordability. This has been an issue. It's been ongoing for many years. I'm wondering about, you said we need investments in open and affordable textbook resources. Not exactly sure what that means, and I'm wondering if financial aid can cover, if there is such thing as open textbook resources, if financial aid is available to students to use that.
Christina Laridin, would you please answer that?
Yes, thank you. So how I would answer that is some legislation that other universities have been pursuing is seeking out grants for open textbooks and subsidies for open textbooks, which essentially create incentives for professors and academics to write textbooks and then put them online for free use and free access to students. As Simran mentioned, the College of Agriculture does make a lot of use of these. Some of that is just simply situational, because there aren't a ton of updated textbooks in the agricultural field, if we're being honest. And so I am fortunate to hardly ever have to buy textbooks for those classes, and so some of that will come from just a changing norm of university professors using more current events, using journal articles, but also investments in incentivizing academics to actually write those textbooks, because a lot of times they feel as though they'll benefit more from selling the textbooks themselves.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to thank you so much for testifying today. It was very helpful for, I believe, us as a committee to hear what your mission and vision is and what the challenges are and how we could be of help. I want to thank our testifiers as well as all the students that were here today in support of you. So thank you very much for being here. And as we move, we're going to move to our next testifiers. That from next week, they from the from the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. The council works towards economic, social, legal, and political equality for Minnesotans of Asian and Pacific Islander heritage. They work to gather input from the Minnesota's Asian Pacific communities and advise the legislator on the nature of issues facing them. We want to welcome you to our committee today, and we have with us the research director at Tay Council, Anjali Mishra Cameron, and Dave Sukaran, who is the research assistant at the Council of Asian Pacific Islanders. Welcome to the committee. And as we just get set up, I want to do a shout out for some young scholars that are here today who are having a snow day. And their father brought them to the committee today. So thank you for coming. Representative Zhang.
Oh, Madam Chair, while they're getting set up, I just wanted to give a shout out. I used to work for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and so I trust that the data in here will be awesome, and Dave will give a wonderful presentation for all of us.
That's good to know. Thank you. Thank you so much. So, who would like to start? And or would you like? How about if you both introduce yourself, and then we will have one of you begin. You can let me know who would like to start. So, would you like to start, Anjali Mishra Cameron?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Anjali Mishra Cameron. I'm the research director at the council, and sitting at my side is Dave Sukaran, our research assistant. And then in the audience, we also have our executive director, Sia Herr, and our legislative liaison, Katie Sly. So give me one moment to finish setting up the presentation, and then we can get started.
And just to give a little background about what we hope to get out today is, again, what your vision and mission is, the challenges and things we need to know as higher ed. And we've allowed about 20 minutes for each of the next presenters, and we're hoping to be able to break away in time to be able to attend the reception over in the rotunda at the Capitol. So members, if you want to be do that, then we all can team together and make that happen, and so we will try to aim for that, but we'll see how it goes here. Minnesota State, I don't know what I exactly said. Okay, go ahead.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. So part of our goal, as you mentioned today, is to talk about the current state of Asians and Pacific Islander Minnesotans, and so when I use that term, I mean Minnesotans of Asian and or Pacific Islander heritage. And so that's people whose families and ancestors came from those nations. We are a state agency charged with representing over 40 distinct nations, including the Pacific Islands. And so I just want to give you a broad overview of the issues faced by our communities and how that might provide a specific lens for you to look within the disparities that face not only our community, but the other communities of color. And I understand that the African Heritage Council will present after us, and then tomorrow you'll be hearing from the Latino Council. And many of these issues are the same, and we represent similar demographic issues, but there are also some distinct differences. And so hopefully you'll be able to pick up on that from our different presentations. So as I mentioned, we are a state agency. We're charged with being an advisor to you, the legislature, and also to the governor's office and the executive branch. We're also an advocate on behalf of our many communities. And so we have a larger Asian Pacific Islander community, and then we represent so many communities under our umbrella. Many of these communities are made up of both immigrants and refugees. Minnesota is unique because it has a majority Asian refugee community. And we're also a bridge builder. And so what that means is that we're not only advocating on behalf, but we're also connecting state government with our communities and our constituency population. So what does this population look like? As you can see on this graph, this is our 10 largest Asian and Pacific Islander populations. One important thing that I already alluded to is the difference between our immigrant and refugee populations. And so we have the Hmong, the Vietnamese, and the Cambodian communities. Those are examples of our Southeast Asian refugee community. And they came to Minnesota to escape violence, to escape persecution. Many of them just came with the clothing on their back and nothing else. We have immigrant communities like our Asian Indian, our Chinese, Korean, and Japanese. These communities came here specifically with for educational or economic opportunities. And so it's important to think about the context by which each of these communities arrived to Minnesota, because it helps inform some of the disparities that we'll see within API communities and compared to the rest of the population in Minnesota. So we are about 300,000 strong, and we are one of the fastest growing communities within the state. And so here you can see on the graph from the Met Council a projected population growth. Many of you are already familiar with this idea that we will, that communities of color are younger than the mainstream population. For Asians and Pacific Islanders, one-third of our population is actually under the age of 18. And so when you look at the graph on the, let's see, you're right, you'll see that this is expected to continue to grow. And in fact, Asians will be one of the fastest growing populations in the state of Minnesota. And so they represent the economic viability along with other communities of color for the future of our state. And that's critically important because it impacts not only how we address K-12 education, but also as we look at future workforce development, and that's certainly relevant to the jurisdiction of this committee. So where are Asians located? They are located in all 87 counties, so every single one of you has an Asian and Pacific Islander in your district. What I really want to point out on this map is the importance of where Asians are located. And so you can see that we're both in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. And what's interesting about this is that there's some commonalities in what draws Asians of different ethnicities. Now, in rural areas, it's not always the same ethnic makeup, but one commonality is that these are locations where there's educational opportunities. If you think about Minnesota state schools, look at what counties those are in and where that appears on the map. Another piece is employment opportunities. So if you look at areas like War Road, where there's manufacturing, we actually have a Lao heritage community in War Road to participate in manufacturing. And in the other graph, you can see our 10 largest communities of residence. And so it's predominantly in the metro area. But one interesting piece that I'd like to point out is the fast-growing population in suburban areas. And so we're seeing more and more Asians move out of the urban core of St. Paul and Minneapolis and into suburban districts. And that's reflected in our K-12 population. And so I know this is the higher ed committee, but I just do want to highlight some of the K-12 population in order to inform what population is coming into colleges and universities across the state. So Asians make up about 7% of our student population, and that's an overrepresentation. Like I said, we're a disproportionately young population. We only make up 5% of the general population. And as you can see, many of you are already familiar with this term, the achievement gap, which represents a disproportionate disparity among students of color and white and their white peers. On the slide before you and in your packets, you'll see that in terms of MCA testing, we see Asian students underperforming compared to their white peers. And this is statewide demographic information. Certainly on the Minnesota report card, this information is available for all school districts. But what is particularly important, I think, is the reading. And one of the challenges that's presented to many Asian and Pacific Islanders is they either have, they come from they are limited English proficient themselves or, and ELL students, or they have parents who are. So the challenges in reading and I can't think of the writing test scores present themselves as a way of demonstrating some of these disparities that we know and see. And so hopefully as I'm going through this, you're beginning to understand the context and how context is important between API communities. And in a moment, I'm going to separate out communities and give you a little bit about each community and the significance of differences between them. I also just want to highlight once again that exemplified in this graph of ELL students, we're seeing more students move into suburban districts. Suburban districts in rural areas than we have been in previous years. And so that's important because that's going to be a draw of resources to meet the needs of these shifting populations. Once this particular graph shows populations of adults over age 25 and the differences between educational attainment. And here, lower numbers are better. That means that they have achieved at least a high school diploma or equivalent. And what's very interesting about this is if we look, for example, at the Asian Indian and Hmong community at the bottom, when we start to look at the differences between communities and how they arrived to the United States, you see a huge disparity within the Asian population. And one of the challenges is that we frequently categorize them all together. But when we think about the context by which these communities arrived to the U.S., where Asian Indians, most of them arrived within the last 20 years on H-1B visas. And so that means that they were highly skilled. They came for educational and economic opportunities. The Hmong population came here as refugees. We have Hmong legislators on your committee today, and I'm sure they would be more than happy to educate you on the history of that population, but it's important to recognize that the circumstances of the immigrants and refugees and even first-generation Americans are significantly impacted by some of these experiences and historical experiences of their communities. And so with a low educational attainment rate in certain communities, we also see a limited opportunity for role modeling in terms of what possibilities are out there for higher education. And I am really excited to share some quotes with you a little bit later on. But first, I do want to mention that one of the things that's really come out is the lack of teachers of color. And this is something that all four ethnic councils are working on together to increase the number of teachers of color. I really like this particular graphic because it highlights the difference in student population statewide and teachers of color available to them. And this goes to that role modeling. This is also reflective of other economic indicators of employment. This next slide is just one indicator. There are many in terms of employment economic indicators for how we can look at communities. And so once again, this is separated out not only by race, but by the five largest Asian groups within the state. And so you can see differences based on circumstances. I highlighted immigrant versus refugees, but it's not as simple as that, and communities are incredibly complex. So I'll highlight the Korean community, which is an immigrant community, and many Koreans have been here for a number of years. However, in a number of research studies, they found, I think in one particular Pew Research study, Koreans reported higher rates of employment discrimination. And so we can see that this plays out in many ways, and it may also play out in terms of their household incomes. The other thing I want to highlight in terms of employment in the API community is something that we call the bamboo ceiling. And so many of you have heard of the glass ceiling, but the bamboo ceiling is specifically around highly educated Asians who are not able to attain leadership positions because of cultural nuances, such as being traditionally more quiet, or a lack of self-promotion, which are not highly valued in Asian cultures, or just a lack of opportunities for promotion. And so that's an important factor in the workforce development of the API community here in Minnesota and across the country. Once again, another economic indicator is housing. And I think, you know, I showed you a graph of educational attainment, and highlighted the Hmong and Asian Indian community, and I'm going to do that again here to once again challenge how we view communities and emphasize the importance of understanding their specific stories. So they actually have identical ratios of homeowners to renters within their populations, despite a significant difference in educational attainment. And, you know, this impacts student mobility. It impacts the ability to pay for tuition if you're putting your money into rent every month. And so one of the interesting things is that as newer communities to the state of Minnesota, there's not an opportunity to build equity, to build stability. And so we see similar renting rates amongst those two populations. One final piece of demographic information that I want to share with you all is around linguistic barriers. And this is critically important because it not only highlights the difference between immigrant and refugee populations, both for first generation and second generation individuals, but it also highlights the urgent need for action on the part of the state in terms of addressing barriers. And so one of our newest refugee populations, the Burmese, are one of our 10 largest immigrant groups. And you can see the astonishing level of limited English proficiency within that population. Some of the first generation of Karen refugees are now entering college and joining the workforce. One of the challenges that we have as a state is addressing this limited English proficient population and ensuring that we're not leaving them behind, because if they are one of the fastest growing groups within the state of Minnesota, we want to ensure that their economic viability is our economic viability as a state. I just want to leave you in terms of demographic information with this idea that we are a community of contrasts. And to look at us as Asians is kind of a misnomer, because it's so much more than that, and it's you have to look at each community with the complexity of how they arrived to Minnesota, where they live within the state, in the way that we would look at any community around the state and determine the factors that led to their current situation. And so I also want to highlight some specific research we've done in-house around this issue, and I think you'll be interested to see the results. So every 2 years we do a biennial legislative survey, and that's to identify issues of importance to our community. And so in the last year, over a four-month period, we surveyed over 800 Asians and Pacific Islanders across the state. You can see the sample of populations, and our intention was to somewhat accurately reflect the population with our sample. And so one of the interesting things that came out from this biennial survey was our highest priority issue was higher education and college. Asians and Pacific Islanders across the state identified this as the most important issue to them. You can see the other issues identified, but this informs our council's legislative agenda and the priority issues that we track and pursue. This is actually new. We are seeing an increase in interest in higher education and affordability, and a part of that is as communities reside in Minnesota for a greater amount of time, they are more interested in pursuing opportunities for economic development. And so I want to highlight a little bit more about the stories from that report. So it was mixed methods. That's my area of research. So I do both quantitative surveys and then also qualitative analysis. And that's really important because with small populations like the Asians and Pacific Islanders, we want to ask ourselves why. Why is higher education important to these communities? And so, as you can see, this is the qualitative analysis of that survey. And so the primary issues, and this should come as no surprise to members of this committee, are about access, affordability, and economic impact. And with that, in terms of access, it's college readiness. Affordability, it came out in three distinct ways: of cost, of financial aid, and of student debt. And then in terms of economic impact, it's not only their personal economic impact, but also the impact on their communities. And so there's quotes on this slide that represent the majority of responses within each of those categories. But I also wanted to highlight some very specific quotes that really demonstrated the importance of this issue. And so I'll let you read them on your own. I don't want to take time to read them out loud to each of you, but they're just really interesting to see how our students are responding, how parents are responding to secondary education opportunities, and just highlight the underrepresentation of students, particularly from our refugee communities in higher ed. But I will read these to you. And so in addition to asking them why higher education was important, we asked, how can the state help address this issue within your community? And so one Chinese community member in Edina said, expose and restrict for-profit schools, educate high school students and their parents about the danger of debt, prepare and encourage students to commit to graduating as quickly as possible. A Karen student in St. Paul said many parents want their kids to be educated, such as going to college but can't afford it. Find a way for everyone to be educated and for people who want to go to college to go. And finally, we have a Vietnamese student in Blaine. And this was I couldn't put it better myself, so I'll leave you with this. Reach out to local residents and listen to understand their stories of struggles. Create more policies that cater towards people who are in need. Create more community events that are inclusive to everyone. So I'll let you leave you with that, and I'll now turn it over to our research assistant, Dave Sukaran, to talk about his own personal experiences.
Thank you, Mr. Sukaran. We do have a number of members, three members who have questions, or four, and I want to make sure we can get through those, and we're running short on time for this segment, so I just want to raise that, and it looks perhaps we're not going to be able to get out early enough to go to the reception, but I appreciate you being here, and I just wanted to let members and the testifiers know where we are at with time. Thank you. And proceed, Mr. Sukaran.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Sukaran. I'm the research assistant at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Usually I'd be presenting statistics or policy or specific ideas, which I would be more comfortable with, but our research director has already done an amazing job with that. So I will be sharing just some of my personal experiences as a, up until very recently, student at the University of Minnesota, and as an immigrant and the child of two immigrants. It's nice to see you again. It must be nice being on that side of the table. I'm an immigrant, and in fact, 20 years ago, my family migrated here from the Caribbean. We're a small population in Minnesota, only about 2,000 of us, but a very significant and distinct population. Now, we migrated to Minnesota for reasons I don't completely understand. Coming from the equator to somewhere where I was afraid this was going to be canceled because of the cold, I often ask my parents why. Why here? Why not a warmer state? But no matter which Caribbean immigrant you ask, that answer is usually the same. It's education. Minnesota's education system is known even back home as one of the best in the states. And for people like my parents, education is a ticket out of the lot that they rolled in life. My father's father was a farmer. It meant that he didn't have to be a farmer as well. I think that goes for everyone, but for immigrants, it can also be a ticket out of the country they were born in. Guyana, the Caribbean country I'm from, is one of the poorest in this hemisphere. And so education takes a higher seat than it might in other communities. My father was the top of his class in high school. He was the top of his class in his engineering program at the largest university in our country. And thanks to that education, he was able to come here and secure a job at an engineering firm within the first year. But his job was as a janitor. I was actually his helper, mini janitor. After school, I would go and help my father, and as I worked alongside him, I began to understand why he came home in not the best of moods. He was taking out the trash for people that he was their academic equivalent of. These experiences are personal, and they're specific to me, but I think they bleed over into the side of education and profession in surprising ways, and I wanted to highlight a bit of that in my testimony.
Okay, and Mr. Sukaran, I just want to make it aware we're going to wrap up the testifying and questioning at 3:35 and move on to the next council. So we have to kind of just balance. We have three members who would like to ask questions. So you can continue, or we can let members ask questions and then go back to your testimony. You can decide.
I can do a really fast version.
Sure.
Okay. The things I wanted to highlight were that these stories that you hear might show up in surprising ways in a student's life. For example, imagine talking to your parent about extracurricular activities when they have given up everything in their life so that you can focus and study. Or imagine choosing a major when they shot for the stars and landed in Minnesota as a janitor. So the higher level policy issues you might face might be coming from very, very microscopic interactions. And I wanted to highlight that for you members. A lot of my friends were not able to achieve their higher education because of tiny reasons like that, that the system doesn't always see. And I think that speaks back to finding the community of contrasts within large communities like ours, and also just listening to community stories whenever you can. And I think we'll leave it at that.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much. So, Representative Lilly. Well, you did not have a question. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was it a question? Just a comment. And going back to the presentation on page number 5, there are two slides there. One is the economic indicators, one of employment, one is economic indicators of housing. And if I'm reading the slides correctly, the information or data from both of these came from the same U.S. Census Bureau in 2015.
Right.
And what stood out at me is that for the employment indicators, the East Asian or the Asian Indian population had a significantly higher salary than every other group. But then looking at the next slide down under housing, they comprised, or I should say 53% of that population was renting. Mm-hmm. And so do I read the slides correctly? No?
Yeah. It's an amazing difference. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lucero, it's an amazing difference. I'm not embarrassed to admit that every time I look at these indicators, I am shocked myself and have to double check the numbers. I think there's a mistake. But it's absolutely correct that there's that difference.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Lucero.
Thank you. So the point I wanted to make is for each of us as policymakers, when we're making decisions, we have to understand that not everybody or populations may have an interest in this particular case, homeownership. And as you know, I've married into the East Asian culture, and one of the things that has stood out with me is the disproportionate members of the population who do rent, and they do so by choice. And I think it goes back to what you were speaking about with the bamboo ceiling. Because of some of the attributes that are cultural, one of those then is also housing. It's a choice. So we just as policymakers need to be cognizant that some of the things that we think other people are aspiring for, they may not be. It may not be the priority. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Mishra Cameron, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah. So I just want to add to that that, you know, there is complexity to that. It is a choice, and it's also in some ways a forced choice if you are an immigrant who's on, let's say, an H-1B visa, which many of the Asian Indian community members are. There's also not, it would not be a wise economic decision if you are requiring a renewal every year of your visa, let's say, to purchase a home if you're not financially capable. And so sometimes it's not a choice because the cards are already dealt for those individuals. And so, yes, absolutely. And I know you know the East Indian community quite well, and I've met your wife, and she is very lovely. So thank you for that.
And thank you. And I do want to remind members that we don't have the analysis of this, so that Representative Lucero was giving one of his experience, what he thinks it is, and then now you talked about the complexity of the systemic reasons why that forced choice might happen. So that was a good discussion to figure out. A deeper dive, we would probably learn even more. So thank you for making that analysis, or bring that analysis to us. Okay, so Representative Kwan, we're going to wrap up with that. You have 20 seconds to ask your question,
and you,
another
Chair.
20 seconds to answer the question, and we're moving on to our next council.
I noticed that you broke out by the different portions of Asia, and I realize there's a great deal of social cultural deltas there, and what kind of barriers that might impact, and some of the indicators, and you touched on that, the renting, etc. It'd be nice maybe if you could pass on to the other, offline possibly, how these differences can be communicated to educators so they can better serve students, because not all Asian students have the same culture.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kwan. That was 30 seconds, so now you have 10 seconds to answer that question.
That's an excellent point. We're certainly trying to do that with educators, and I also want to highlight in your packets, we are working on a research report that specifically highlights some of our smallest Asian communities but may impact school districts and your own districts disproportionately. And so in the back of that, you'll see a document that refers to the Emerging Communities Report with that purpose in mind. But just if I may take another 30 seconds, we are an agency charged with serving you in state law. And so if you have any additional questions or follow-up about the communities within your district or about anything presented today, it is our statutory duty to answer those questions for you. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Mishra Cameron and Mr. Sukaran. You were very informative, and thank you so much for that excellent presentation. Thank you. Okay, our next council that will be presenting to us today is the Council of Minnesotans of African Heritage. The council's work over the past 39 years has yielded impressive achievements and mobilized community leaders committed to advancing Minnesota's quality of life. With us, we have the council's executive director, Justin Terrell. Yep. And Mr. Terrell, welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your presentation. And if you have another presenter, maybe you can introduce her as well.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Jasmine Carey. Jasmine is our legislative coordinator.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
While we wait for the presentation to get booted up, I will just take a moment to say thank you for inviting us and for taking time to get to know the councils. Madam Chair, this is a committee that's very important to me and important to our state, and we look forward to providing the services to legislators around the table as best as we can. Also, while we wait, I just want to acknowledge that in the room right now is Dr. Abdul Omari, who is currently in the process of trying to get reappointed to the Board of Regents. I'm just going to take a minute while we're waiting to say that my phone has not stopped ringing, my email has not stopped going off, and there are a lot of community members who asked me to advocate for him. And so I just want to take a moment to acknowledge the work that Dr. Omari has done on the Board of Regents recently, you know, obviously helping the U of M find a new president. So I'll end my comments on that subject there.
Hey, thank you for that.
Yeah.
So we're still trying, and could, since we're waiting to get started, could our other testifier spell your last name so we could get it for the record?
Yeah, for the record, it is Jasmine, last name C-A-R-E-Y, first name J-A-S-M-I-N-E.
So Ms. Carey, do I have that right?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're just... For those of you who are listening at home, we're getting the presentation set up. And I'm happy to report, committee members, the time we've allowed for this presentation is 20 minutes. You did a good job. We've got there. We're going to go to the end of our committee for this presentation. And thank you for helping us get there. We're just not going to be able to get to the Capitol on time, but maybe there's still an opportunity to visit with people at the end. Okay, proceed, Mr. Terrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am aware of time, so I'll kind of keep this high level. So thank you for the kind introduction about the council. As you stated, we've been around since 1980 in different variations. We were originally the Council for Black Minnesotans. In 2015, we were rebranded as the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. We're here to advise the legislature and the governor on issues that impact our community, and we're doing our best to do a good job at that. I've been in this role for a little bit over a year now, and it's been fun, and I'm excited to share with you a little bit about our work.
Thank you.
So the structure of the council, we have 11 members appointed by the governor. We have four legislative members, two from each body, and majority and minority party. We have four paid staff. For the first time, we're fully staffed. In over a year, we're fully staffed. So Ms. Carey here on my right, and Patrice Bailey is our outreach coordinator, and Shakira Bradshaw is our office manager. The work of the council can be divided into two basic buckets. So one is statewide outreach. I'm excited to see Representative Samantha Vang at the table, because we are in your district. Well, we weren't in your district, but we hosted a meeting with folks from your new mayor. Came to a meeting we hosted in Brooklyn Park a week or so ago. And Representative Wolgamont, we also have constituents in his area that we're working with as well. So we do a lot of statewide outreach. And the second part is just to work on our legislative agenda, which Ms. Carey is leading that strategy. So I'll start with our legislative agenda. So last year, our priority bills was restoration of voting rights, the African American, which was vigorously debated in committee in the House. Representative Lucero, we appreciated your comments last year. It was nice to engage with you. African American Family Preservation Act, which is addressing disparities in child protection. You've heard a little bit about the Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers Act from the Asian Council. And then last year, there was also the Asian Council also worked on a domestic violence and sexual assault prevention bill that we supported as well. We also had two items that were taken action on by Governor Dayton. In the officer-involved shooting of Thurman Blevins, the governor directed the public safety commissioner to work with the council for a meeting, first of its kind, to have the BCA meet with the community in North Minneapolis during an open investigation of officer-involved shooting. It was a very tense meeting, lots of communications and conversations that turned out positive in the community in the weeks that followed. We learned a lot of lessons I'm willing to answer questions later about. And then also the veto of the protest bill that we heard from our constituents not to support a bill that would increase penalties on protests that shut down highways. And so we were very active in representing the sentiment of our community on that. And the governor vetoed it. This year, our priority bills, restoration of voting rights. We continue to advocate for thousands of Minnesotans whose rights to vote have been disenfranchised. We continue to advocate for African-American families impacted by the child protection system. And then this year we're taking up black immigration as an issue. As you know, driver's licenses is something that's been debated in this body for a while. And deferred enforcement of deportation and temporary protected status are two federal policies that will just have the impact of these policies on black immigrant communities is just terrifying on the Minnesota economy in general. And so we want to try to bring resolution to the suspension of these policies at the federal level so that our families in Minnesota can have some stability. Some additional focus areas outlined by the council is housing, workforce and economic development, healthcare for all, education, transportation, and criminal justice reform. Obviously, we can speak more in general about those issue areas. So, just a little bit about our criteria for how we come to these legislative priorities. I'm not just making these up. However, you know, there's three key things. So first, the policy must be led by folks from our community, by our constituents. Second, there must be a statewide impact. So we're not just, while we may support folks looking for direct appropriations to their small nonprofits and whatnot, that's not going to be our top priority. We want more people of color navigating the process at the legislature. We want more of our constituents doing that. But the policies we support have a statewide impact. And then, obviously, we want there to be real people attached to this. So in respect to DED and TPS, thousands of African immigrant families are going to be impacted by that. How are we doing on time, Madam Chair?
We have, 14 minutes.
All right. I think we're doing well then.
Mm-hmm. Very well. Thank you.
So our outreach efforts, I'll kind of go through these really quick. So we started last year with a list of about 500 folks, and we expanded that to over 2,000. We developed relationships in the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Rochester. We hosted and sponsored over 50-plus events, and we mobilized 300 constituents to show up at the Capitol, which may not seem like a lot, but we just don't want to take credit for a lot of other folks who showed up that we supported, but we can count 310 actually that came at our invitation. This year we're just doubling down. We're going to focus on developing leadership groups now that we have relationships in Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, Rochester, and Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center. We're sponsoring and co-hosting events at the Capitol this session. And then, obviously, we're launching a survey on issues, which we previously had done, but we've taken the time out from that until we can bring in additional resources around research to help with that process. This fall, we're going to host the annual meeting, and our goal this session is to mobilize 500 constituents, starting with our Day on the Hill, which all of you are invited to. So on Tuesday, February 26th, we'll rally in the Rotunda. Attorney General Keith Ellison is going to be our keynote. Ashley DeBose and Tish Jones have agreed to perform as well. And we're working with the National Panhellenic Council to make sure that as many folks from our constituency base across the state come down. And that includes folks from Duluth, Rochester, and St. Cloud. So you see the student group from St. Cloud University. They're really excited about this event. So I'll keep this kind of high level just for the sake of time. But looking at the challenges facing our community, this first slide kind of says it all. So we have about 425,000 black and African folks in the state of Minnesota. Our data is not very well disaggregated, which I can speak to more later. But most of us live in the Twin Cities area, right, 80%. And you can see the breakdown by county in the sort of seven-county metro area. We're talking about 80%, 44% live in Hennepin County. I'll just go back to this slide, is that if you look closely, there's a bunch of little red dots popping up in greater Minnesota. And that's your Somali farmers. That's, you know, Austin, Minnesota, where you have 10% of the workforce at, at Hormel is by Sudanese immigrant folks. So there's these small dots popping up all over the state, and those are the folks that we're trying to build relationships with and hear more about housing issues in Faribault and whatnot. So then those are, so that's something that we're looking into, that we're working on, is our growing population across the state. So once again, I'll go through this really quick. These are numbers from the demographer. So median household income in the black community is, as if you look, it's on the increase. However, you see there's a big disparity between the Asian and white population and black and the black and Latino population and American Indian populations. We're going in the right direction, but obviously we got a lot of work to do. Once again, poverty, percent of poverty, the trend is down. But if you look at the on the far left, the 10% for all Minnesotans in 2000, I believe this is a 2017 survey, as where black folks are 28%. So while the trend is down, the disparity is, I think I would call that a crisis. Unemployment by race, once again, the trend is down, and yet our community is twice all Minnesotans. This slide right here, this is a new sort of data for me to kind of explain. This is, I feel like, really helpful as we talk about economics. I mean, you're the higher ed committee, and so obviously the point is for folks to come out of our colleges and get jobs. Well, what we're noticing right now is that the trend right here, so you have on the far left, full-time, year-round employment at less than $35,000, and then you have full-time, year-round, greater than $35,000. Part-time, part-year, less than $35,000. Part-time, part-year, greater than $35,000. This is your gig economy slide. You can see where the where in general Minnesota, you know, we do have a lot of jobs, but we're looking at less than $35,000 full-time, right? And then when you look at the black community, you see that there's a whole lot of part-time work there for over $35,000. But once again, that's your gig economy. So you're working more jobs to make more money. This is the working poor slide, if you will. So on higher education, we are focusing on three things. Once again, we don't have in-house research capacity, so disaggregate data. So I would love to have one of those slides that Anjali presented where it shows you all the different beautiful diversity in the black community, Somali, Liberian, Nigerians. I mean, the right now our numbers just don't reflect, and we're really excited about the census coming up this year. Access and affordability is a continued concern in the African heritage community. And then, of course, we're supporting the increase of teachers of color and American Indians. I won't get into the bill. These are the key components, you know, attract and prepare folks, increase program completion, increase retention, and then increase the percentage of teachers of color and African and American Indian teachers. But I believe the goal is 1%. So I was going to take this slide out. Ms. Carey was like, Ms. Carey informed me, you know, speaking to legislators. And so you kind of know this stuff, but I figured I'd leave it in just because I like political education. Look, the way things are is not an accident. I met with the Mapping Prejudice folks this morning, and they showed me, you know, 100 years worth of data that says, you know, the way we end up in these situations is by policies, and that there is an actual infrastructure that has been, you don't write laws by accident, right? You guys are very intentional. And so I just always think it's important in the community when we're talking about policy and advocating at the Capitol, remember the way things are is not an accident. And then the second thing that goes with that is that people-made problems can be people-solved, which I'll just end with my little plug for why I stay in Minnesota, even though it keeps being named as the worst state to live if you're black, is because there's so much hope and opportunity here. And that I believe that this is the one place where we can address the racial disparities that we see across the board in every category. We can be a model and a city on a shining hill for the rest of the state. Oh, country, my fault. Questions?
Members. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This being the higher ed committee, there is, you know, and in college nowadays, there are more ladies than men. In the African-American community, that disparity is greater. What can we do to get more, you know, high school, teenage African-American males to, you know, take that opportunity? I wish it was, because a lot of them saw trade, certification, some of the non-standard, but I fear that the cases, they aren't pursuing some of those options. And I guess, how can we try and fix it so that, you know, they see that dream in front of them,
mm-hmm.
and pursue it?
Madam Chair, Representative
Mr. Terrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Kwan, I appreciate the question. I often like to say that, well, first I just want to respond to the statistic data. So the recent data I actually saw from the demographer, it still lists African American men as completing more degrees in higher ed. And I'll double check that. I know I'm on the record, but I'll double check that and provide that information. I just think it's important to remember that, because I do think that, frankly, gender plays a big role in what people obtain, aspire to, and we can talk more about, like, the impact of patriarchy on educational goals. But I would also say that, to your question, I think we're stuck in an imagination battle, right? Like, I think change is science fiction. You have to vision something that's greater and beyond what we're currently dealing with. And the young men that I mentor in North Minneapolis, who have all found themselves in some random part of North Dakota playing college football or whatever, like, part of that is the story that they've been told about what college and higher education is. And I do think we need to examine that story and, meet people where they're at and re-envision what success looks like. Because I think the story that we're telling right now is a little dated. And I appreciate the work of this committee and the policies that you all take on, and I'm excited to see where this conversation could go around encouraging more folks of color to apply and engage with college.
Representative Baum, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I know that the North Side, and so there are organizations out there that we maybe have isolated successes. If your organization can help bring to us so that we can maybe analyze those successes and then cross-pollinate that to, help a greater portion of the community and of the state. I would appreciate that and would be of assistance if I could be.
Mr. Terrell?
Madam Chair, Representative Palm, I welcome the conversation. I also would just encourage us to continue to look at the question is, who is being successful and who is failing, right? I would argue that our systems we should think about racial impact assessments. We should think about not the one or two who make it, but how do we serve the whole? And which is the message I carry from our community? You know, that's what our constituents say.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. When you said we were the worst, I went, whoa, it can't be. So I quick did, hey, Google, right? And USA Today gives us the worst rating of 4. We're the 4th worst. And so I'm wondering, as we're looking at policies going forward, especially when we are looking at growth in the African-American community, if you were to wave a magic wand and say we're going to fix one thing right away, what would that – I know you mentioned education and this is higher education, but what would be the one policy that we should focus on first?
Mr. Terrell.
Madam Chair, Representative – I apologize.
Cleavorn, sorry.
Representative Cleavorn, thank you so much. The magic wand question, I deeply appreciate it. I apologize. I'd probably put a little more energy into answering the question if we had a magic wand. The reality is
we don't
have a magic wand, right? And I think that, and I do think the magic wand question helps us vision, like, beyond where we're currently at.
Exactly.
Right? I don't know that there's, like, one place to start. You know, the home ownership rates, and Representative Lucero was speaking about home ownership rates. We're talking about less than 1% in African Heritage community. That is a crisis, right? We have crisis in every category. And the idea that we're going to pick one to start.
No, with, I know. You know, it was a question of really a greater view.
I deeply appreciate the question. I apologize for the attitude. But I do think that we have to realize we're trying to solve a big problem. There's a lot of problems. Yeah. We need a lot of hands. And
I welcome those conversations. I would love to partner with you on being part of the solution. Part of that man-made solution that you discussed.
And we do have one more member, if you will bear with us for one more moment here for question. I would like to have Representative Poppy ask a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question about your council membership, if you are at full strength.
Representative Mr. Terrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Poppy, we are not. So currently we have... five members on the council. Governor appointees, two members. So Representative Rena Moran and Senator Hayden both serve on the council. And then we have several openings in the community. I think the one pager inside of our report, I should talk about the documents I gave you. So each of you has a copy of our annual report, as well as a one pager on our agency, as well as our legislative agenda. But we currently have about six openings on the council.
Okay. Well, thank you for your excellent testimony today. And I should have mentioned this to the other groups as well, but I just want to let you know that we welcome your testimony on legislation that we are proposing this legislation. We appreciate your input on what legislation is needed. So I just want to extend that invitation and look forward to our work together and serving all Minnesotans. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the meeting is adjourned.